So when we're looking at this path really is that place of the unification, the and all the supernals are interconnected. And so when we look at the paths of the supernals, we're looking at difference of emphasis rather than fully separated things. But the emphasis on this path, this place of Dalit, the door, the place of the Empress, is on this energy of manifestation that comes out of the fusion of Chokhmah and Bina, of will and love. And it takes us into the mystery, we're right on the edge of that mystery of what emerges out of the triangle of the supernals and what happens as we approach the supernals, as we place, and what happens is we're in this mysterious place called Da'at. And subtle place, really, because it's called, the word Da'at means knowledge. And yet, if you seek to know in the kind of conventional sense of way, it completely stops you accessing that deeper part of the dream. So it's the knowing of not knowing. It's the original notion of gnosis in the Greek tradition. One who knows, the one who knows is the one who knows mystery. Who is the one who has gone into the deep place, who has... And returns with an echo, or just as Jenny was saying, returns with a memory or an echo of that kind of knowing. And yet, that echo in itself, while it is an echo and a memory, is also a powerful gift that enables us to progress in our life in whatever way we need to do that. Now, Alexandria is one of the, which is where the meditation took us this morning, is one of these places, in terms of the Western mystery tradition, is a very fundamental place. Because it is a place of the fusion of traditions. So in a sense, when we're looking at this path, which is about fusion and out of fusion, a new life emerging, the creativity of opposites coming together that creates something new that didn't exist before. City of Alexandria did not exist before Alexander. It was a little fishing village. And it was basically a little limestone outcrop on a... in the middle of a great big swamp of the delta. And what Alexander himself does, which is, he's this great conquering, very, very young man, student of Aristotle. So one of the things when you think about Alexander, we're not thinking about some barbarian king. This is somebody who was taught by one of the greatest philosophers the world has ever known. Directly by Aristotle. It's a bit mind-blowing when you think about it. So, and he builds on the work of his father, Philip of Macedon, who created this very powerful military machine. But his father, Philip of Macedon, was very content just to sort of dominate other people and steal their gold. Alexander has a vision somewhere, a vision of a larger place, a larger empire, a place of where the place founded on the Greek values of inquiry and democracy and all of this kind of ideas, but also that has an idea of inclusion within it. And he challenges and defeats the great Persian emperor at that time, Xerxes. And the Persian vision of empire is based upon the cultural imperialism of Persia. It was not a inclusive vision in that sense. Because what we find Alexander doing as he extends his rule, as he defeats the Persians and drives them back, as he takes control of Egypt, he becomes very influenced by Egyptian tradition. He's taken to an oasis called Siwa, where there is an oracle of the god Amun-Ra, and the priests rather cleverly tell him he is the son of Amun-Ra. And what he does is to create, but what he does and what happens as a result of it, he doesn't do much of this. He sets in motion. So he creates Alexandria. And Alexandria is this new city that has the same kind of impetus that you find in the founding of America, where this is intended to be a city where there will be that where traditions will come together, where the East and the West will meet each other, and where wisdom will be cultivated. And what you find arising out of Alexandria is a fusion of Greek and Christian and Roman and ancient Egyptian traditions for a period of time is this really remarkable kind of flowering, really, of human culture, which sadly in the late 4th century starts to fall apart with the rise of political Christianity and the which eventually destroys the old cultural fusion, really, basically, and then shortly afterwards the library is sacked and burned by the Romans. So this it's like all these things, like Camelot, these are moments that exist for a period of time, like Toledo, actually, in the golden age of Spain. There are these moments in human life where there is peace and there is communion and colloquy, and something amazing happens out of that fusion of differences. And it always then gets overturned. It always then gets destroyed, because it's somewhere, you know, there's something about these other tendencies in human beings that want to tear down things that are beautiful and have the promise of something greater. And always, you know, in human life, again, because we're working with this great field of opposites, we're working with a capacity to create beauty, but also there is that human capacity to want to tear it all down and create monoculture rather than be with the power and the beauty of difference. You know, that's something we're seeing massively in our time, really, in all kinds of ways. But in this first flowering of Alexandria, what you see is this extraordinary, beautiful city gets built, which is a fusion of Greek and Egyptian architecture. And above all, you have the creation of the Library of Alexandria, which was again a foundation, a seed that Alexander himself put in motion, and becomes this place where the idea that all the wisdom of the world will be gathered here. So it becomes when ships came into the great Alexandrian harbour, the port authorities would search them to see if they had any manuscripts on them. And if they had any manuscripts, they weren't allowed to leave until it was copied. You know, so they were really very serious about the gathering together of human knowledge. The other great artifact of Alexandria is the Pharos Lighthouse, which sits out there in the harbour, which was a literal lighthouse, a most amazing eight-sided figure. So it was both a literal lighthouse and very handy for shipping, but also it quite consciously was made in the image of being a sun that shone out of Alexandria. So it was the light of Alexandria shining across the world. Now, of course, as I say, the whole thing, you know, in the Roman period falls apart, and you get the rise of institutional Christianity, and also you get these literally raving gangs of monks who tear down the temples, they kill the great woman philosopher Hypatia, who's one of the great neo-pagan, neo-Platonist philosophers, and the Alexandrian dream vanishes. But it sort of remains in the human psyche as an archetypal image, as an image of a city of perfection. It's one of the deep images of the idea of the city where the city where people live together in peace, where opposites are loved and creativity is cherished. And it becomes, in a way, in human myth, it becomes the place of the solar king, the son of Amun, Alexander, who is the young man who dies when he's 32. He becomes ill, and his empire goes off into Afghanistan, and one of the things you find much later on in Afghanistan is, and you get this in Buddhist tradition, you get these extraordinary Buddhas wearing togas. It's from the Gandhara kingdom in northern India, because a lot of the Greek Macedonian soldiers settled in that part of Afghanistan, and so you get this kind of cultural kind of fusion between the West and the East that comes up in really unexpected ways, and that's really one of the great qualities of Alexander's empire that's different from maybe some other traditions, where there is this enormous colloquy and conversation that seeds itself in all kinds of unlikely places. But Alexander himself becomes a figure of myth. He becomes an important figure in medieval Europe as Iskander, the magical king, and even today, people are still looking for the tomb of Alexander. His body was embalmed. He was brought back from India. He was buried first. He was buried first of all in Saqqara, which is the traditional place of the pharaoh, where pharaohs were buried. Apart from, one of the two traditional places, the Valley of Kings being the other. Well, I suppose three really. Originally, it was Abydos, but anyway. But at a certain point, his body is removed, and partly because of the politics of the Ptolemies. Now, the Ptolemies Ptolemy was one of the generals of Alexander, who become after. Because what happens when Alexander dies? The empire is divvied up between the generals. Ptolemy gets Egypt, and so you get the dynasty of the Ptolemies, one of which later becomes Cleopatra the Great. So the Greek rulers of Egypt are called the Ptolemies, and as part of the politicking, at one point the body of Alexander is taken from Saqqara and is reburied in Alexandria in an extraordinary tomb. There are the descriptions of this incredibly beautiful tomb of Alexander, which has never been found, and much of ancient Alexandria is now beneath the waters of the Mediterranean. It's unlikely to be in the Mediterranean, otherwise the remnants of it would have been found. It's much more likely to be under modern Alexandria somewhere. It probably never will be found because of that, really. But in a way, that sort of doesn't matter, because actually, in some ways, the myth of Alexander, the myth of the lost tomb of Alexander, becomes a sort of a great myth and a great and like most of these myths, they if you like stay in the collective human imagination as the image of a possibility. And this image of the king, of the philosopher king, taught by Aristotle, who literally brings the East and the West together, because goes into India, and who creates this magical city, that is the city of the sun, that is the city of wisdom, that is the city where the East meets the West, and that is dedicated to the development of wisdom, remains really in the collective human psyche as an icon, as an inspirational kind of image. But one of the things, one of the literal things that comes out of Alexandria, out of that fusion of traditions, is a lot of enormous creativity. And before the rise of political Christianity, you find a Gnostic form of Christianity appearing. and which has contemplation and the cultivation of inner wisdom as its principal practice. Now, one of the great lost teachers of Christianity that we find, who lived just outside Alexandria, is a man called Evagrius Ponticus. Evagrius, the builder of bridges. Now, he is a disciple of somebody called Origen of Alexandria, who is another one of the great teachers. And they eventually become classified as heretics. But what Evagrius taught was a threefold system of training. First of all, something he called the practicus, where you learn to work with the disturbances of the mind and the heart, and learn to work with he's very influenced by Egyptian tradition. So Evagrius in Christianity is the originator of what later becomes the seven deadly sins. But he is not talking about them as sins. He talks about the seven logissimoi, which are the seven thoughts that deaden the heart. Now, those of you who looked with the Book of Gates with me will remember the seven Geb staffs that are the seven places the Geb staffs. So the Book of Gates is an ancient Egyptian book that talks about the movement through of the sun through the 12 divisions of the night. The first journey is down into the depths, where there is the death and the resurrection of Osiris and Ra, and a renewal. And then there is an ascent to the new horizon, which brings about the new day. Now, just after the resurrection moment at the deepest part of the night, there are these figures, the seven Geb staffs, which are, and they're just images given of a staff that's like an Anubis staff, for the staff with an Anubis head, with two people bound to it. And then each staff has a mummiform figure with hidden arms that is watching over the particular staff. Now, each one of the staffs is connected to a quality that obstructs, a quality that takes us away from light, and stops the process of ascension and resurrection. Now that idea, and these priests, that people are tied back to this staff. Now, the image of the Anubis image is used because Anubis is the opener of the ways, and what is being described in that back to back binding is a loop of thought and feeling and memory that keeps us trapped around a particular locus, something that. Now, that is the reality of the logisme, the thoughts that deaden the mind. Now, the first part of Evagrius's teaching is designed to free us from these deadening kind of thoughts, to reach a place of peace that he calls apatheia. Now, the deadening thoughts are things like distraction. Well, a particular one is acide, which is that sense of heavy depression that keeps strapping around us. And I'll talk more about the logismite at another time, but the particular quality of and they're sometimes described, later again they get described as demonic forms, but they're actually kind of constellations of thought and energy and feeling that entrap and separate and break up the unity, the mirrored unity of our tree. So the very first sequence of training that we have with Evagrius is how to work with the seven logismi, and how to free ourselves, and how to reach this place called apatheia, which is a place of stillness and peace. And then that opens then to a a second part of training, which he calls the Gnostica, which means the knowing, which is from having freed ourselves from the, if you like, the self-referential loops of thought and feeling. We are simply present, and we start to look into the depths of presence. And so, well, what is it like when I'm not caught up in these loops of thought and feeling? Here I am, we're back with this microcosm, macro, the beginnings of this process of mirroring the micro, the macrocosm and the microcosm mirroring each other. So the second part of the thing, the Gnostica, is about the beginning of that process. And then there is a third process that he calls the Cephalia Gnostica, the head of the Gnosis, the root of the Gnosis. And this is where he takes us into the what he calls the deep contemplation. And the deep contemplation begins with the contemplating of the principles of providence and judgment, in our terms, Gedula and Gebura. And looking at and really seeing that, not just as some, you know, personal loops, but noticing that at work within our nature, within the nature of the universe. So those are the first two contemplations. The third contemplation is the contemplation of corporeal bodies. Substance, contemplating the nature of who we are. The fourth contemplation is the contemplation of the incorporeal, that which has not form, or not a form that we recognize. And the final, the fifth contemplation is the contemplation of the Holy Trinity, which we would call the contemplation of the supernals. Underneath all of this, Evagrius would say, is the principle of logisai. And this takes us back to the beginning of the Gospel of John. In the beginning is the Word. In arche hose logos. The word logos can be translated as word, but more accurately is conversation. In the beginning is the conversation.
Can you say the Latin again? Can you say the Latin again?
It's Greek.
Greek.
In arche. En hoto logos. In the beginning, there is the Word. But more accurately, in the beginning is the conversation. Because what we find both in the Holy Trinity, in the way that Evagrius understands it, and in the supernals, as the Kabbalists understand it, is in the beginning there is a conversation, a non-dual conversation. The deeper nature of the human being is the logisai. And what he says about this is, he talks a lot about the, I'll just read you the bit from Cephalia Gnostica. Five are the capital contemplations under which all contemplation is placed. It is said the first is the contemplation of the Holy Trinity, which is to be worshipped. The second and third are the contemplation of the incorporeal and of corporeal bodies. The fourth and the fifth are the contemplation of judgment and providence. The light of the intellect is divided into three: the knowledge of the Holy Trinity, which is to be worshipped, the incorporeal nature created by it, and the contemplation of corporeal beings. So this comes out of Cephalia Gnostica. So this is this place where the deep contemplations of spiritual life. This is the place where the tree of life, in a sense, is simplifying into the sense of, as we did in this meditation, beginning of the sense of the body. Literally entering in more deeply into our bodies, into the mystery of the cells, the mystery of the DNA, the mystery of matter itself, the quantum nature of matter, which as we penetrate more deeply into the into the corporeal, into substance, takes us immediately into the incorporeal, that is the underneath dialogue that creates the appearance, the seeming of substance, and is not separate from it. And the doorway into that, is first of all the capacity to work with the internal loops of thought and feeling and memory that keep us entrapped, and to reach that place of apatheia, which is that kind of stillness from which we can contemplate the activity of judgment and providence, which having done so takes us into the contemplation of the corporeal, which leads us to the incorporeal, which then ultimately leads us into the contemplation of the Trinity that's at the root both of our being and the root of the universe. And what he goes on to say, in that to get more deeply into this, he said that you need to meditate upon the logoi of things, immaterial, and the logoi of bodies. So the particular conversation that creates the corporeal body, but then what is the conversation that creates the incorporeal? And as we penetrate those conversations, we ultimately find ourselves up against, connected to, the fundamental conversation that creates everything. But as he quite rightly says, that the knowledge of the Trinity is beyond contemplation of any kind. So something flips around, something happens as we come from the corporeal, even the incorporeal contemplation. And we come then into the mystery, which we touch, we penetrate, and then we emerge from with the memory, the knowing, the traces, what Proclus, the successor, would have called the sunethamata, the traces of divinity.
How do you spell that?
Sunethamata. 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 So there we are then, we're done.
Can I just ask a question about the Greek, the people you've just been speaking about, the two men? Where are they? How long has Alexandria been going?
That was fourth. So basically, Alexandria is founded in the second century, I think it's the second century. Evagrius is in the fourth century. I'll just check that actually.
Is this BC?
Alexandria is. No. AD. So Alexandria is founded in 331 BC. Evagrius of Ponticus is 400 AD. Rome takes control of Alexandria in 30 BC. Alexandria itself falls out. Roman Alexandria falls to the Arabs in AD 641. So Evagrius is late on in the history of Alexandria, and he exists at a time when Christianity is very dominant, and so he's a very power. He becomes regarded latterly as a heretic, and his teachings don't flow. So he's teaching he would not have been seen in his time. He was one of the, and he still is regarded as one of the church fathers, certainly in the Orthodox Church. But his teachings become neglected in favor of a much more politicized and simple version of Christianity. So Evagrius dies really towards the end of he's dead by the 399. So he's only lives 50 years basically. So he kind of did a lot in that time.
And in time, lost a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still going actually.
I just think Camelot being associated with art, but the two seem to exist together, one goes, the other goes, and Alexandria is there as an entity for that legacy lasts a long time.
Well, it does, in a sense, you know, it just continues. If you read, you know, if you read Loris Derrell's Alexandria Quartet, yeah. You know, you find again it's always been this city of fusion of West and East and in fact it crops up in Jung's work, which I'll talk about after lunch, where he writes this. I'll just read you the beginning of it. The Seven Sermons to the Dead, written by Basilides in Alexandria, the city where the East touches the West. So that appears first of all in the Red Book, but also it's the only part of the Red Book that's published up until the Red Book was published a few years ago. And so that for him, that image of Alexandria and the particular kind of Christianity that was manifesting in Alexandria was very important. So it continues in all kinds of ways, really. Okie dokie.